Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today marks the final day of the Crop Consultant Conference. There are a lot of really good sessions on the agenda today. I talked with Taylor Chalstrom about two of them. Here is our conversation.
Taylor, I understand that we have a researcher that you and I both have interviewed who will be doing one of our sessions. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yes, that man is Mark Bolda, who is a UC Cooperative Extension strawberry and caneberry farm advisor from Santa Cruz County. He'll be talking at the conference about managing fusarium in strawberries. This is one of the one of the most recent talks that we added to the conference. What he'll be talking about is fusarium wilt, which is a growing as a major disease in strawberry. And so in this post methylbromide era, you know, he wants to describe the disease, kind of discuss the identification and biology of the causal agent, which is Fusarium oxysporum FSP fragaria, and finish by discussing current and potential management strategies for grower success going forward there. So I think it will shape up to be a really good talk.
I interviewed Mark on exactly this topic. I did an article for our Organic Farmer magazine. And I have to tell you, Taylor, he is one of my favorite people to interview because he is so enthusiastic about what he does. Have you found the same thing?
Yes, yes. Mark Bolda loves his job, and it's just like a really refreshing perspective from a journalist perspective to see that, you know, just how much detail he will provide about one little thing, one little aspect. And he only works with strawberry and caneberry. And so he still is just so, he loves it. And so, you know, if he loves it, then we love it. That's just kind of how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. He is the expert for strawberries and caneberries. Now, of course, fusarium, the topic that he's speaking on, is a major problem in strawberries and can be very difficult to manage. But he has had some very good advice, and you and I both have been able to report on that. You did a podcast with him, right? And I did an article.
Yes.
So people who want to know more about that after they go and hear him talk can also find more from our various websites as well.
Yes. He'll be talking at 10:30 a.m.
And that's one where you should definitely bring like a notepad and some pens, because there will be things that you want to write down.
Yes, yes, there will. And I know specifically he will bring up the fact that there are tons of different types of fusarium fungi that exist, but the one that causes this fusarium wilt in strawberry, this huge problem for growers, is just this one specific one. You know, I remember him mentioning a lot of different types of fusarium don't really affect strawberry that much, but it's just this specific one. And so you'll definitely want to hear about it.
You know, another thing that I was very interested in when I interviewed him was talking about prevention too, and everything that goes into preventing the spread of it, and how, you know, it is possible if you're very diligent and careful. So he was kind of good information.
Definitely, definitely. And I'm sure he'll be mentioning some of those prevention methods as well. A lot of them, you know, are these physical prevention methods, just from preventing it from entering the field in the first place. A lot of, like, you know, kind of disinfectant factors, and just generally being careful and, you know, studious in what you're doing.
All right. Thank you. Okay, Taylor, and you have one more that you wanted to talk about. What's the next session?
Yes, I do have one more. This session is about cover crops in California, and what we know, it's going to be a pretty general overview about cover crops. And that speaker will be Jessica Cantor, who is part of the UCCE Small Farms and Specialty Crops program in Fresno County. And she's conducted some trials in cover crops along with Shulamit Schroeder, who is also part of Cooperative Extension, and very knowledgeable about the subject.
So cover crops are a big subject right now. A lot of people talking about cover crops and different ways to use them in crop management, the benefits to the soils and using cover crops. So there's a lot of information that people want on this topic right now.
Yes. And it is kind of another one of those, you could say, controversial topics for a couple reasons, but you know, there's a lot of research that has gone on in the past and is currently going on to further prove cover crops' benefits to growers, you know, like improving water infiltration and reducing nutrient loss, that type of thing. And it can also be used in an IPM setting for certain situations as well. A lot of the grower concerns surrounds kind of lack of rainfall to provide water to cover crops. In some orchard settings, cover crops, I've read from some of the UC researchers have said that cover crops can use up quite a lot of water in the orchards. And, you know, that can maybe not be ideal in years of less rainfall. So you'll have to irrigate those cover crops and use more water. But Jessica has done actually a fair amount of research on cover crops, and her most recent project, I don't know if she'll be discussing it in her presentation, but her most recent project, when I spoke to her, showed that, you know, some cover crops can require little to even no water and still flourish in their biomass. And so there is a lot of promise in that regard.
Yeah. And we've had a couple of good articles in our Progressive Crop Consultant magazine on this topic too. In fact, that she, I believe, had written or submitted that just, again, go to show some of the trials and some of the information. And so there is a lot to learn in this session.
Yes, there is a lot to learn. In that recent article that Jessica and Shulamit wrote, she talked about, you know, a couple of research trials that they did in the Southern San Joaquin Valley. And, you know, they looked at how well these different cover crop mixes suppressed weeds, how well they provided resources for beneficial insects, and again, also improved water infiltration. They got a lot of good data from there. It's a good read.
All right. And then when is her session?
Yes, Jessica's session is at 11 a.m.
All right. Thank you, Taylor.
You can still head down to the Visalia Convention Center today. Find more information online at myaglife.com. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns live in person on September 16th and 17th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this must-attend conference features 2 days of educational seminars, a live trade show, and honorariums and scholarships given by Western CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Hear the top experts in their field speak on pest management, artificial intelligence and new technologies, as well as the latest on soil health, nitrogen, and irrigation management. DPR and CCA credits will be available over the 2 days. For more information on credits, topics, and registration, visit progressivecrop.com/conference. Agrimiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agrimiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agrimiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlante is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlante wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com. Welcome back. Here's your news for today. Local irrigation districts in California are suing the state board over water supply cuts. Irrigation districts in several Central Valley farm communities are suing the State Water Resources Control Board over its recent water curtailment order. Lawsuits filed in Fresno and Sacramento County Superior Courts claim state officials overstepped their legal authority in halting diversions from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. According to the California Farm Bureau, the August 20th Water Board action effectively cut off surface water supplies to 4,500 California farms. Meanwhile, the latest U.S. drought monitor shows short-term dryness expanding in the Midwest as the western U.S. deals with a prolonged severe drought. Above-normal temperatures largely offset any benefit from patchy rainfall across Northern California and the interior Northwest. The Midwest dryness favors summer crop maturation fieldwork, including harvest efforts and winter wheat planting, but is reducing topsoil moisture. Meanwhile, long-term drought issues persist across the upper Midwest, despite some recent rainfall. The Department of Agriculture also reported that topsoil moisture was at least one-third very short to short in each Midwestern state except Wisconsin. Short-term dryness and drought has become more apparent in recent weeks across the southern sections of the High Plains, including parts of Kansas and Colorado. Farmers and ranchers who depend on the Colorado River face water cuts following a water shortage declaration. Michael Klimich shares more on what this means for those producers.
The Interior Department last month declared the first-ever Colorado River water shortage, resulting in further water allocation cuts for farmers and ranchers. Farm Bureau Associate Economist Danny Munch says a shortage is declared when Lake Mead at Hoover Dam falls below water elevation of 1,075 feet as defined as Tier 1.
As of last week, the elevation was 1,068 feet, or 35% of the total capacity of Lake Mead. An important distinction here, though, is that Arizona and Nevada were already in drought contingency plans, which is not an official shortage, but includes mandatory cuts.
Under the regulations, Arizona will lose 18% of its water allocation and Nevada will lose about 7%.
And combined, those states generate over $6 billion in agricultural receipts, including $1.1 billion in cattle and calves, nearly $1 billion in dairy products, and $3.5 billion in crops. Arizona on its own produces half of the nation's lettuce, 20% of the nation's spinach, and a slew of other fruits and vegetables. And further cuts would really threaten the operations of thousands of farmers and ranchers across the region, especially as cuts deepen to other states like California.
Farmers in the Upper Basin are dealing with water cutbacks as well.
The Upper Basin spans Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and a small northeast piece of Arizona. Lake Powell at Glen Canyon Dam has fortunately been able to remain above the minimum threshold limit of 3,525 feet, but that's still only 32% of its total capacity. And we know from our Farm Bureau survey that farmers and ranchers in the region are already dealing with reduced water deliveries, making pretty drastic operational changes to limit their water consumption.
Read more on the Market Intel page at FB.org. Michael Klimich, Washington.
The U.S. dairy community is reaffirming its commitment to be part of the climate solution, pledging to address its total greenhouse gas footprint. The industry also is setting goals to achieve carbon neutrality, optimize water use, and improve water quality by 2050. In addition, U.S. dairy is strengthening equitable access to nutritious dairy foods worldwide, while ensuring animal and employee welfare through a transparent production system. Ahead of the Food Systems Summit, the UN solicited game-changing ideas, initiative, and innovations that can bring about positive change. Healthcare facilities in rural America with plans to increase services and improve facilities have an avenue of assistance via the USDA Rural Development Grants and Loans, Rod Bain reports.
What are some examples of the Agriculture Department's Rural Development Mission Area providing support to rural healthcare facilities so they can offer needed programs and services to their communities and regions? In the state of Maine, a recovery house in the northernmost county, the only one in that county at that, needed renovation. As Bill Flagg of the Center for the Advancement of Rural Living explains.
At the time we were looking to refinance the men's recovery house here, we were also looking to open a women's recovery house.
After looking at traditional financing avenues, a center board member recommended a visit with a local rural development official about available funding programs. This led to the successful application of both a direct community facilities loan and community facilities grant. That funding enabled not only the renovations at the men's halfway house, but purchase and renovation of a new women's halfway house as well.
One of the things that's advantageous about the USDA program is that it's a 40-year mortgage, which is extraordinary. That is not normally the thing when you go to conventional financing. And in addition to that, the interest rate on the loan was half of what we were paying originally. So because of what the USDA did, our mortgage payment every month is more than reasonable.
Meanwhile, the rural Texas-based Cactus Health Services was outgrowing its lease facility in a non-commercial area. What was service to?
All patients in this two-county wide area, and then we also get patients from all the way up even from the city of Odessa, that's an hour and a half away, to come see a clinic like ours, a federally qualified health center.
That offers medical and dental services, according to CEO Luis Villarreal. The increased number of customers prompted Cactus Health to inquire about USDA Rural Development healthcare related grants and loans.
It took us a year and a half to get to where we needed to be. When we came in here at the beginning of 2019, it was such a joy to walk into this clinic.
A constructed modular building with expanded exam, lab, mental health, and intake offices among its improvements. Villarreal, however, notes another impact: expanded staff and staff training.
How can we make you more successful? And if you do that and you treat the staff right, and that's going to be a plus for the patients, because that's the way you want the patients to be treated.
Among Rural Development's grant and loan programs in its portfolio is the newly announced Emergency Rural Health Care Grants. RD is accepting funding applications for that program through October 12th. More information is available through state rural development offices and online at www.rd.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A contingent of farmers and farm employees gathered at the California State Capitol last week to urge Governor Gavin Newsom to veto legislation that would allow a union organizing system known as card check. Assembly Bill 616 is now on the governor's desk. It would allow alternatives to secret ballot elections for forming unions. California Farm Bureau urges preserving the secret ballot. It says allowing organizers to instead collect signatures from employees may lead to coercion and intimidation. Are livestock producers getting their fair prices from meat processors? Are consumers paying fair prices for meats? Gary Crawford has this report.
Retail food prices went up 3.5% in 2020, and that might be expected considering the huge supply chain disruptions caused by COVID. Food price analysts thought that prices would level off or even drop a little bit this year now that the supply chain problems of 2020 have been smoothed out. But no, prices have continued to go up and could end up rising another 3.5% above last year.
About half of the overall increase in grocery prices can be attributed to beef, pork, and in poultry. And in beef and in pork, we've seen double-digit increases in prices over the last couple of months.
Brian Deese directs the White House National Economic Council. He and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack held a press conference over at the White House the other day. You may ask why the White House is concerned about this. Brian Deese says first in the U.S. meat industry today,
the top four meat processors control 85% of the market.
So producers of cattle, hogs, and poultry have very few choices as far as selling their animals, very little bargaining power, so there's very little competition among the companies. Secondly,
the four top companies in these industries have seen record or near record profits in the first and second quarter of this year.
Third, those companies have been paying livestock producers less for their animals. And fourth, consumers are still paying more.
It raises a concern about pandemic profiteering.
Brian Deese stopped short of using the phrase price gouging, would not venture an opinion on whether or not some of what's going on might be illegal, but he did go as far as to say,
these price increases that are affecting consumers are not happening in isolation, and that companies are making decisions to drive these price increases.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters, legal or not, the farmers who raise the cattle, hogs, and poultry are not getting a fair deal.
You know, it's not something we're dreaming up here. The profits are real. The fact that producers are not making a profit, I mean, I remember talking to a producer the other day in Council Bluffs, and he said, I don't get this, Mr. Secretary. He said, I just sold my cattle, and I lost $150 a head, but the processor made $1,800 a head. How can that be?
So he says the administration is going to be taking several actions toward two main goals.
Goal number one is to make sure that farmers get a fair return for their efforts and their capital investment. And the second goal is to make sure that when consumers go to the grocery store and they're at the checkout counter, they get fair prices.
How to achieve those goals? A major topic of discussion last week at the first meeting of the President's Competition Council. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's our news for today. Today is Friday, so that means we highlight a couple of the top segments for the week. That's coming up right after this.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety at Western Agricultural Processors Association, about a new proposal to mandate electric forklifts for the ag industry. Welcome, Priscilla.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here today. Priscilla, my first question for you here. California Air Resources Board, or CARB, recently announced the next iteration of their large spark ignited regulation for forklifts, which is known as Forklift Rule 2.0. What does this new proposal potentially entail for the ag industry?
Absolutely. So this is, like you mentioned, this is the second iteration. So this is Forklift 2.0, as it's known, or really the large spark ignited regulation is what the official title is, but Forklift 1.0. We, in agriculture, little history, I guess, to go backwards, we were treating it a little bit differently when the initial rule came out, and there was a couple of reasons for that. But we were given different timelines and a different emissions factors to have to meet because of three things. One being that ag operations only operate seasonally, typically 3 to 4 months of the year. We are unable to pass along costs from these purchases of these expenditure costs from purchasing forklifts. And additionally, for those that use rough terrain forklifts, the technology simply does not exist for those lower emissions at the time to go any lower than what was provided to us. So we had a different timeline and we had different emission levels that we had to meet. Now, this time around, what they're saying is they want to do electric across the board. The mandate would be for everybody. Everybody would be treated equally. So potentially that would entail everyone in agriculture would be required to have electric forklifts, regardless of their operation, regardless of their size.
Just comparing the original rule to this new rule, you know, you said they made some exceptions for agriculture in that old rule, but they've kind of, in a way, tossed out those exceptions now. Why have they moved in that direction, do you think?
So, and I mean, this is in line with what the administration is just going to, right? So there's been this recent push to do all electric in vehicles. There was the earlier this year, COVID kind of mixes everything up in my head. I don't know if it was earlier this year or last year, where they talked about the vehicle mandate by 2035, all vehicles would be electric. So it's definitely the administration's push to go that route. So that's hence why we see forklifts going in that way as well. So that's the difference. Now, we are working with CARB to educate them on the reasons why ag operations were treated differently in the past. And for the reasons I stated earlier, we were treated differently because we weren't able to meet those mandates. It's not cost effective for ag operations, right? We're only running 3 to 4 months of the year. Your equipment is sitting there for 8 to 9 months out of the year. So it's not doing anything. There's no way to pass along those costs. I mean, we were a warehousing operation running 12 months out of the year. That makes sense. You can break that down over time, right? And the cost doesn't seem so significant, and they have the ability to pass along those costs, and we simply don't have that ability.
Priscilla, you know, CARB now wants, you know, like I said, to treat the ag industry the same as these other manufacturing operations, and you kind of just went into it a little bit, but why is that really problematic for certain producers, you know, like tree nut producers?
Right. So like I say, I touched on it a bit, but you think about an ag operation that runs 3 to 4 months of the year, and you think about another facility, say a warehouse facility that's working 12 months out of the year, 24 hours a day. Now it's difficult to compare, right? You can't, it's not comparing apples to apples. It doesn't work that way. So to try to mandate something like that on producers who simply, it's simply not cost effective, right? Does it make sense to purchase it? It's like purchasing a vehicle yourself and just sitting it, having it sit there for 8 or 9 months of the year. It's not doing anything. It's not producing anything. Well, we only use it for 3 to 4 months of the year, and it's not producing anything any other time of the year. So to have that capital expenditure when we cannot pass along those costs, it doesn't make sense. It's not cost effective. And I mentioned to you earlier on the rough terrain. So specifically in the tree nut industry, the rough terrain forklifts are used just because of the rough terrain, right? So whenever you're driving on, say, like a warehouse, when you're driving on cement, something that's flat, it's easy to use electric equipment. When you're talking about out in rough terrain, hills, dirt, mud, gravel, you simply can't use electric forklift because it doesn't have the capability to do that, to maneuver in those areas. And rough, and right now, as it stands, rough terrain forklifts don't have that technology available. It doesn't exist. Now, at this last CARB meeting that happened, the CARB workshop, there was a manufacturer who said that they had this low emission forklift, rough terrain forklift. So there's obviously, there's something that we can look into, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for the situation. So that has to be evaluated to see if it'll work.
They're looking into lower emissions, but that still isn't electric. Do you know of any manufacturers that are looking into electric, or is that just not really on the horizon?
Absolutely. No, that's just not in the horizon. Just for you think about the horsepower on a rough terrain is typically a lot higher than you're talking about your forklift. So it just simply does not exist. You'd have to imagine the amount of batteries you'd have to have. And it's similar to something like a tractor, right? If you wouldn't, how do you do a tractor, a forklift, electric tractor? You would need a trailer just with batteries to be able to operate. So it's simply just not feasible at the moment. Yeah.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Hi, we're back talking with Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety at Western Agricultural Processors Association, about a new proposal to mandate electric forklifts for the ag industry. Priscilla, CARB has also indicated that they believe it is actually cheaper to own and operate an electric forklift than a propane forklift. What evidence are they using to support that claim? And is it really accurate?
So that's a great question. So the information that CARB has used to substantiate this claim that electric is a more cost effective than propane, they're using national data information. So yes, the information is accurate. They're using things like their sources are Electric Power Research Institute, American Electric Power, Propane Education Research Council. So the information shows that it's takes anywhere from 6 to 7 to 10 cents, basing it on a electric rates of 6 to 10 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, that's a national average, which is correct. However, that is not correct for California. We are not based on the national average. It does not reflect what we pay in California. We pay amongst the highest electricity rates across the continental US. So wouldn't it be fair to use those numbers as a way to substantiate the fact that it would be more cost effective in California to operate electric versus propane? So when you think about that, when you make that analysis, you really have to look at what California is paying. And so what we did was we surveyed our membership to see what exactly are our members paying, what are the rates here in California. And from what we had, we seen anywhere from 14 cents per kilowatt hour all the way up to 35 cents per kilowatt hour. That's a huge difference from the numbers that they're using to substantiate that claim. So clearly that is part of the education portion and being able to reach out to our membership and provide that real data to CARB really does help make a difference. So just making sure that we're presenting this information, letting them know these assumptions that are being made aren't accurate for California.
I'm kind of curious why CARB, you know, opted to use the national numbers if they must have known that it's more of a generalization than it's not specific to the state. Why would they kind of misrepresent it like that?
So I don't necessarily know why their assumption was based off these sources, but I will say that it's just simply not accurate for us. So I can't say why it was used or what the reasoning was behind it, but I just know that it's not accurate for us. Hence why we are now educating them on these are the real numbers that work for California.
Priscilla, my next question here, you talked about this a little bit already, but you know, there is a lower emissions rate that's being considered for rough terrain forklifts commonly used by tree nut haulers. You talk to the manufacturer or you kind of know what the manufacturer is offering, how feasible is that proposal? And is it nearly as severe as the electric mandate?
So there's a couple of things with this one. On the rough terrain forklift, as I mentioned, there was a manufacturer that spoke at a CARB workshop recently who said that they had this like super low emission rough terrain forklift. Now we still have to look into that. This is not something that I have vetted yet. So I can't say that it's something that exists per se. Obviously, we are not necessarily against lowering, if it's feasible, whenever this is feasible. If it is feasible, it makes sense, right? So even if you're talking about electric, if it's feasible and makes sense and it's cost effective, we are not against it, but it has to be feasible. So like I mentioned earlier, there's a manufacturer who's saying it, if it's feasible and it's something that can work, then absolutely we would be supportive of it. Obviously, there's no way to do an electric mandate on a rough terrain. So is it a severe? Well, it's not even a possibility there. Another thing that I would say is that at CARB's last workshop, they did also talk about exempting rough terrains from this proposal. So rough terrains could possibly be exempted. They did specifically say it was for outdoor operations on uneven ground. So sometimes that verbiage or that language can be confusing. What does that mean, uneven grounds? Because in tree nets or hullers, it's not necessarily uneven grounds, but you do have gravel, you do have dirt, you do have mud. So those environments don't basically allow for anything besides rough terrain forklifts. So there's just some little nuances that do need to be corrected, but nonetheless, they have considered removing rough terrain forklifts from this proposal or on this mandate, which would be a great thing.
Maybe speaking on that consideration, they're making a little more. What do you think, maybe if you can speak on this, the chances of them doing that are at this point, what information does CARB need to see to maybe make that exemption?
I think we're getting a lot closer than we were in the initial discussions of it. They did include it, like I mentioned, they did in this last workshop, they did include rough terrain forklifts as an exemption on their proposal. So I think, like I said, it's just little small nuances on the uneven grounds or verbiage that probably needs to be removed or not limiting in terms of what rough terrain is, because some folks have different definitions of what rough terrain is. So I think this is something that can definitely be worked with CARB. I don't see that one being as large of an issue at this moment in time, just because they seem like they're moving forward on the right path with the rough terrain forklifts. So it seems to be going in the right direction, but we can never say it's a win until it's a win.
All right, Priscilla, we got time for one last question here. I do know that Western Ag Processors Association is pushing back against CARB. That's been pretty obvious to what you've been saying here. But, you know, what are you guys actually doing? And, you know, maybe how can producers help?
Obviously, one of the things that we did and we thought was the most important is making sure we had accurate data. So we did send out a survey out to our membership, getting accurate information on not just electric rates, but also cost and operation and maintenance of what it actually costs, because we do have some folks who have electric forklifts. So we wanted to get that difference, right? Propane versus electric, what's the difference? What's the operational cost? So getting that information, gathering it up and being able to provide that to CARB is going to be really important. So we did receive that information from membership and we're working to compile that information to be able to present to CARB. Now, in addition to that, we are also working with CARB and other ag stakeholders, and we'll be having a meeting here pretty soon in the near future to discuss where exactly ag is on this issue. In addition to that, we will be writing comments. We're in the process of writing comments right now to CARB with all the issues that we kind of described today and letting them know what our issues are and why, and making that and writing that down. So that's kind of where we're at right now in the process. They are expected to come out with another workshop in October. So we continue pushing forward on this, continue having the dialogue with CARB and other ag stakeholders that make you sure we're in coordination for this effort.
I just want to ask one last little side question here with maybe some of the submissions that you guys have gotten from your members up to this point. I don't know if you can speak on this, but maybe what are the percentages of roughly some of your members that have electric forklifts to propane?
It's a little bit different because we have both processors and haulers. So in our hauling operations, it's not feasible to have, or it's less feasible to have electric. So those numbers aren't as high. But in our processing facilities, again, where it's feasible, you can see some processing facilities, a third of their fleet is electric or a quarter of their fleet is electric. So it really just depends on the operation, the type, the grounds, and whether or not it's feasible. So it really just depends and varies. But we've seen quite a bit of operations have both forklift and electric. Again, propane forklifts and electric forklifts, but propane is going to be the majority right now.
Well, this is obviously a serious issue coming amongst some of these other regulations for electric vehicles and agriculture at the moment. Hopefully, Western Ag Processors Association and CARB can come to some form of an agreement or at least meet in the middle on this as it benefits haulers and shellers and other producers. Thank you, Priscilla, for coming on today and providing some insight on that.
You're welcome, Taylor. Is it okay to add something?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things that I did want to add is, aside from what WAPA is doing right now, I think another thing that's important for us to work with on CARB is making sure that we create an incentive program around this as well, just like other incentive programs that have been for tractor, ATVs, ag pumps. So there have been very successful incentive programs that have helped both, you know, it's a dual process. So where it's CARB, the air district and agriculture working together to turn over those types of equipment. So something like that, some program like that, I think is going to be perfect or ideal when we're trying to talk about some type of a mandate for forklifts. So doing something of that nature is going to be key as well.
Okay. Well, we hope to see a program like that sooner on the horizon there. I think, you know, like you said, that could be really beneficial for maybe adopting some of these practices. Thank you for noting that and for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Taylor.
Of course. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.